Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Paul Murray. He's a very, very, very funny Irish writer. He's written three books, the most recent of which is called The Mark and the Void. The second has the hilarious title Skippy Dies, death being always a funny subject in Irish literature. His first novel, An Evening of Long Goodbyes. Given this enormous history of comic writing that comes from Ireland, whether it's Swift or Wilde or Joyce or Flann O'Brien or Beckett, does that put a special strain on you to come from the country that has given us our very best comic writing ever anywhere?
Yeah, that there's a certain weight of history that every Irish writer has to labor under. I don't know that it's a bad thing necessarily. I mean, I'm from Dublin. If you're coming from the same city as James Joyce, who's written like the great Dublin novel, I think it means that you feel like you really have to try to add another book to the Dublin literature pile. So I think it's a salutary thing in some ways. People in Ireland like talk all the time and they joke all the time. Like it's a country that's historically been dominated and oppressed by, you know, an endless sequence of empires. So it's given people, the Irish people, kind of a fairly sort of ironical sense or an ironical way of looking at the world. The kind of the natural way that you would view the world is to, you know, mock it or make fun of it or poke holes in it. And so when I sit down and write a book, that's naturally the way I'd be drawn to doing it.
Now, you've said that your favorite moment, I don't remember if it's of all time or in Beckett, is in Waiting for Godot, that a character decides that he's going to hang himself, takes off his belt in order to do it, and his pants fall down. That's the inevitable connection, isn't it, between laughter and death? Do you feel it in your own work? I'm saying so because the first chapter of Skippy features a character who dies at a donut eating contest.
Well, that's true. I think like all three of the books are about death in one way or another. So the banker who's who's narrates the new book, The Mark and the Void, is kind of dealing with the death of his father, and he's mourning. And I think Pynchon had a line somewhere about how death was sort of the only subject for serious, you know, fiction. So, and it's something that I just find myself kind of writing about or around with each book. But I think the only way to do it is in a humorous way. I mean, death is like the ultimate absurdity, and just shows up that, you know, whatever you do, no matter how great your station, you know, we all come to the same sort of sticky, embarrassing end. So that's the...
These characters discover they're workers in a bank. What's the name? It's a hilarious name.
It's Bank of Tarabundo.
Tarabundo is a island.
It's a made-up Pacific island that's been turned into a tax haven.
Yes, the Dublin branch of such probably would never exist, yes? Because aren't these tax havens secret?
Well, Dublin Dublin effectively became a tax haven in the late 1980s. Ireland's a very small country, and as I say, it's been at the mercy of various colonial powers over the centuries. So since independence, you know, the government's had like various desperate strategies to try and stop the place from going bust, you know. So one of which was to attract foreign investors by, you know, offering, on the one hand, extremely low tax rates, and on the other hand, more importantly, a very, very light regulatory touch, you know.
And this new novel, The Mark and the Void, is a comedy.
Yeah.
About banking disaster. And in particular, about what happened to Ireland after being regarded as the most globally successful economy in the world as it went kerplunk.
Yeah.
This couldn't have made the Irish very happy. Is this book regarded as truly funny or ironically funny or bitterly funny? What is the response to it?
I think the response has been fairly... I think there's a lot of stuff in the book about cultural amnesia and the way that Ireland in particular deals with its problems, which is to try and sweep them under the carpet. Like, historically, the Irish people have had a real issue with, you know, accepting, you know, the crimes in our own past, the terrible things that have happened over the centuries. And with the kind of the current banking crisis, you can sort of see the same kind of cycle of like amnesia and self-exculpation occurring all over again, you know. Which is sort of a terrifying thing. So when the boom happened, so we had this boom in between 97 and 2007, that was one major kind of pivot point in Irish history, whereby Ireland, from being this historically, legendarily downtrodden place, you know.
The land of the potato famine is how it was presented to me.
Yeah, it was bleak, and the only thing we were good at was writing books, you know, and flagellating ourselves, you know. So it was this big boom, and the place took off, and suddenly Ireland sort of transformed into, as you say, this global superpower, and everybody forgot about everything that had happened hitherto. We redefined ourselves as we were no longer religious, we were materialistic, and we were no longer moral, we were sort of ruthless individuals and so on. And then when the crash happened in 2007, that was another major pivot point where that whole reinvention disintegrated as completely as you can imagine an idea doing.
And what we have in this book, The Mark and the Void, is a cast of characters. They might have been ordinary file clerks, but they became bank examiners. Our hero is a bank examiner from Paris, named, of course, Claude, and he wears a very black sports coat with slightly long hair. He's very fashionable without very much effort. But because there's not much effort, there's not much personality either. Well, his father told him that he should be successful, but now Claude has become successful, and his father is jealous. His father is jealous that Claude can afford a limo, can live in a beautiful apartment, can make, for a bonus, more than his father ever made in a year for a salary. Claude is not all that bright. He works hard. He's facing the screen way into the night. He knows what he has to know, but like his colleagues, he's a wage slave. The people who are having fun are the people who are taking potential investors out to stripper bars, and so this is a world as unpleasant as any world has ever been, except now it's in Ireland too. Yeah,
well, that's exactly it. Like, it's an entirely, for Ireland, it was a model of living that you know had never existed before, and suddenly it was being, not only had it been imported and transplanted very successfully, but ordinary people beyond the world of banking and finance were being told, these are the guys, you know, and this is the life, and this is success. That's what it looks like. And all of these very new models of success, they're kind of inescapable during the boom. So Claude is, yeah, like he's not sort of super smart, but he has made the trade-off. I guess this, like, it's, again, it's like an old story. It's this Faustian pact, you know. You can have, like, literally anything you want so long as you surrender the desire for it in some way, you know. If he kind of separates himself from the world, so he doesn't really, or no one in the sort of banking environment, they don't have friends, they don't have, you know, love doesn't really exist in the same way. That any kind of togetherness, all of those things are sacrificed in order to sort of to achieve this monetary success.
I'm talking to Paul Murray about his new novel, The Mark and the Void. It's been published here in America by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. And then along comes a novelist. A novelist who may even be named.
His name is Paul, yeah.
And that may be Paul Murray, who says to Claude, you are so boring. And the modern novel, post Madame Bovary, is about dull and boring people. I would like to follow you about. You notice I have already started. I'm that person in black following you around. Could I come into your office day after day and watch what you do? So at first he sits politely, watching Claude do nothing but pound at keys. And he tries to say to Claude, I need an event in this novel. I need a bank robbery. But he doesn't realize that investment banks don't keep cash on hand. There are no safes to crack, even though he's brought in a safe cracker. There's nothing. It's the adventure of a culture that has replaced the possibility of excitement with nothingness. Yes?
that's well put. Yeah. You're sort of, it's really strange to live in a city like Dublin. It's a very old city, you know, it's more than 1,000 years old, and it's so like awash and dripping with history, you know, and trauma and pain. But to see this kind of like these citadels of nothingness kind of coming in right in the middle of the city, and just that kind of emptiness take hold. Like it's such an un-Irish way of being. And I guess at the same time, that's why it was so attractive to the Irish. You know, we thought like, well, here's a chance to escape our, you know, the enormous wound that is Irish history.
Well, not only that, these people, except the ones who are taking rich clients out late at night to stripper bars, these people cannot even be Irish in the old ways. They can't drink all night. They've got to be in the office early. And they're not there in the office to do things that can be done hungover. It's detail work. And so all of the famous Irish traits that at least we get the pubs at night, and we get the girls in the pubs or the boys in the pubs. At least we get the pubs. All of it is disappearing. And we're watching how, even in one of the most exciting cultures, the culture of Irish culture, which is a culture of gossip, it's said about Dublin that a secret told at the north end of Dublin will be known in the south end within half an hour, if that. And that's in part what Ulysses is about. Mm. You're watching gossip going from one part of the city to another as it gets transformed by people who've misheard it.
Mm-hmm.
That is Irish comedy.
Yeah.
And the great threat being proposed is not just poverty, but the disappearance of
the Irish personality, that they're going to be grunts and bores like every other kind of businessman.
It's not just an Irish phenomenon. I think, like, the way that sort of the world is going, the Western world is going, is that increasingly we're being pushed into, you know, our own little private well of loneliness, where we don't see anything except what's on the screen, and what's on the screen is just a reflection of ourselves, you know. And, like, just life is increasingly siloized and silent, and the idea of actually talking to someone becomes like something that we kind of think is almost sort of, I mean, you talk about Ulysses, and it's just a book about, you know, people bumping into other people, you know, by accident and having these kind of conversations. But like modern life seems, the whole drive of it seems to stop those encounters from happening, to take any kind of risk, the risk of talking to someone who's not exactly the same as you, trying to remove that from possibility. Ireland is, like, it's a very small country. You know, there's 4 million people there, and it's everybody, it's not that everybody knows everybody else, but there's really only sort of 2 degrees of separation between you and anybody that you might meet. Which is to say that it's sort of a testament to how powerful those forces of money were that came in during the boom, that they're able to, it's very difficult to sort of put on airs in Ireland because the culture, because everyone knows everyone else, and the culture is one of mockery. So if I sort of walk down the street in my new hat, you know, it's only a couple of seconds before someone calls me, like, one of the words that you said I'm not allowed to say on air.
And I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Paul Murray about his book, The Mark and the Void, and we'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Paul Murray about his latest book, The Mark and the Void, a novel where the fabrications of literature and finance collide. When I went to Ireland for the first time, it was the 100th anniversary of Bloomsday. And I didn't know that I'd see James Joyce's face on the money currency, or the whole city full of people dressed as characters from Ulysses. It is, or was, a literary city. Places that appear in Ulysses are still visited by tourists from around the world who are charting the day life of Leopold Bloom or of Stephen Dedalus. Did that disappear? And would you say it's an American influence that came in and provided a model for what rich people should be like?
So Ireland's relationship with its writers is historically, I think, is a kind of fairly fraught one, in that most of the ones writers who were any good left or were chased out. So like Joyce left, Beckett left, Flannery O'Brien didn't leave, but he killed himself with alcohol because he hadn't left. And Joyce, like, well, Joyce is represented now in Dublin as being this kind of categorically Dublin, categorically Irish figure. That's because they know how to make money from them, you know. Like for a long, yeah. For
yes, I saw it. They were selling sausages in his name. Yes.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, it's, you know, if you get an Aer Lingus flight, you know, there's woven into the seats, there's quotes from Ulysses. You know, I think a lot of the people who you saw at Bloomsday, not all of them. There are many great Joyce aficionados in Dublin, but a lot of them are tourists. You know, Joyce was. He was critical, again, he was critical of a lot of the sacred cows of Irish society, you know, and he was taking potshots at you know, at a lot of people. So for a long time, he was regarded, like when I was in school, I had a priest tell me that, like, Joyce was, he on the list of sins that you could commit, you know, like never have sex, never take drugs, and don't read James Joyce because he's a charlatan that's conned, you know, thousands of people, and he's just a person to be avoided. So now, I mean, the way that sort of, it's interesting to watch the way that like history is recuperated in Ireland when it's safe to do so. So for instance, like in Skippy Dies, I was writing about how in the First World War, the Irish participation was kind of erased from the history books, like literally left out for years. But in the last kind of decade or so, it's now kind of okay. We feel sort of like safe enough in ourselves to brook talking about the Irish in the First World War. And Beckett and Joyce and the great writers are now sort of long enough dead that they're not enough of a threat. We feel like they can be sort of subsumed into sort of the Irish project in a way that's sort of safe and that everybody can enjoy in kind of a fun park type way.
The book is about both the death of literary culture that is assuming somehow that if a writer writes about a bank, he'll be able to break into the bank safe and make a good deal of money, not from the book, but from a scheme around the book. And similarly, the banker is going to be practically absorbed by the computer screen. He's become so dull, so responsible, so unable to cut loose. These people have really become, let's take another step back. Joyce was famous for borrowing money and not repaying it. He would sing in the pub an Irish ballad. If someone would pay him, someone would give him a number of pounds. He had, it was said, a beautiful voice, and he knew all the songs. That was part of being Irish. A businessman in Ireland was worried about how he'd feed his children. So suddenly we've got both aspects of culture turning into something empty and exploitable. As you say, the only thing to do with the bank crash in Ireland is to write a funny novel about it, because it's too sad otherwise. You're writing about the disappearance of an Ireland that people still think they can travel to see. Now tell me, if they visit the country, is it still there, the countryside?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't want to be... Like, the book is kind of is pretty critical, I guess, of things that were happening in Ireland at the time. But I live in Ireland. That's how much I love Ireland. I stay there. You know, I'm gonna keep living there, and you know, unless I'm driven out. And it's a wonderful country in many ways. Like, it's really beautiful, but more importantly, it still has this sense of warmth and togetherness and friendliness. Like, if you go into a pub in the country, people will talk to you and they'll want to know your story and they'll want to know who you are. And so I'm hoping that, you asked earlier about this, was it an American model that came in? And it was an American model that came in, this model of like ultra ruthless capitalism, and this drive to be, you know, for the individual to succeed at all costs. That was like a very American idea. Because we've always looked to America, you know, because Ireland has like been so benighted, you know, that America is where you went. You know, it was the only place you could go to escape the poverty and so on and so on and so on.
Oh, in my parents' day, I was Mr. Sheehan and you were Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Sheehan were a famous vaudeville couple. They were what give rise to Mr. Bloom and Mr. Daedalus.
Right.
The Irish and the Jews, wherever they go, lost.
Lost,
and wandering the earth wherever they find to settle. And in a certain way, you know, how can one complain about prosperity except that it robs the great identity of sorrow? Sorrow is part of what makes a culture. You can't help it.
Yeah.
The respect for sorrow. I was talking to someone about song titles like I Can't Give You Anything But Love or The Best Things in Life Are Free. How sad to live in a world where no one can believe that anymore. And, you know...
True, like that idea that all of those things that we used to prize, like the best things in life are free, we have now found better stuff. It was just a case of technology. We waited long enough.
Yes, we've now found better stuff. Exactly, Paul. Yes, you know, there are toys.
Yeah.
Our toys are not free.
Yeah.
And they are the best things in life.
They have now replaced love.
Yes. Yeah. And we get a whole saga of songs about material living. You know, maybe Madonna brought it in, but it hasn't stopped. That sense that love is not a rescue, it's not barely existent. Or, you know, trusting people. What about that? How could we? So a comic novel then makes fun of the end of the world we once loved, you know. It says, let's get back to the sadness of life. It at least gives us comedy. Sorrow's companion is comedy.
Yeah, it's like Lord Byron says, and if I laugh at any mortal thing, 'tis that I may not weep, you know? So there's a communality to that as well. If you can find some sort of, if you can turn, like, you know, the classic Irish way of dealing with these terrible darknesses that sort of weighed down on us over history was just to make a joke of it, you know, and like you turn it into something, you can take possession of it in some way then, you know, you can give yourself some little grasp on what's happening and share it and preserve yourselves in a way that isn't available otherwise. But now you're told like that the way you can deal with your problems is there'll be some monetary solution, and that's how you do it, you know. And the idea of community and all of those things is those things have just been kind of, we've just been waiting to move those things on, you know.
I've been talking with Paul Murray, author of The Mark and the Void, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Thank you very much, Paul, for joining me.
Thanks, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Mark and the Void at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when we revisit our interview with Salman Rushdie.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FD Weekend wherever you listen.